You're listening to a DM podcast.
Just a quick warning, this podcast series contains discussions about crime, trauma, sexual abuse, drug use, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised.
I used to rob banks in the 80s and 90s and did 23 years in prison in three different states. It took 30 years to talk about the sexual abuse that happened to me and the spiral into crime, addiction, and depression that all occurred as a result. Now, having turned my life around, I talk openly to inspirational people about trauma, survival, transformation, and hope. I am Russell Mansa, and this is The Stick Up. Glenn Fisher is a survivor of institutional abuse. Glenn Fisher has brought many high-profile pedophiles to justice with his steely determination to get justice not only for himself, but other survivors. Glenn Fisher, welcome to The Stick Up.
Hey mate, how you going, Russ?
Really good. Glenn, let's just kick off by starting where did it all grow up. You grew up in the western suburbs, similar places I grew up in Mount Druitt, Lethbridge Park.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Shelby, Mount Druitt and Bibwell, family also in Lethbridge Park and St Mary's. That's sort of my stomping ground for the first 10 years, I guess, of my life between there and institutions.
And what happened in your life? Your trauma started from a very young age. Can you explain how that came about?
Yeah, so my mother was a heroin addict. When she was pregnant with me, she was a heroin addict. She ended up giving up the heroin and becoming an alcoholic whilst pregnant with me. There was a lot of violence between my mum and dad with the alcoholism and the addiction. My mum got clean when I was, as I said, when she was pregnant with me, but it was around the age of seven when things really started to take shape. I'd been removed from home multiple times for multiple reasons. And this time I came home from school one day and my dad was in a bull wagon. He'd been charged with a pretty serious crime and my mum had a nervous breakdown and went into psychiatric care. So they sent us into a place called Lewisham, which was an orphanage back then, big red brick building. We were the only four kids in there, Russell. At that point, they took my youngest brother and sister out when my mum got out of psych care, and then they moved us firstly to a place called Stewart House, and then Bernardo's moved us over to, I think it was Burwood, somewhere around that area.
When you mention those names, in the work I do at The Voice of a Survivor, I know of the institutional abuse that took place in both of those places you just mentioned. Were you the victim or a survivor of any abuse that took place in them places?
No, not in the orphanages. I wasn't, as far as sexual abuse. That didn't start until I got into Darick. That sort of took shape.
How old were you when you went to Darick? And what led you to going there? And were you a state ward for Darick?
No, I wasn't. So the funny thing is that all of my siblings have been made state wards. For some reason, I wasn't. It doesn't make sense. And there's multiple reports in my records to references to being made a state ward, but it didn't happen.
Well, can you just explain what a state ward means, please, mate?
Oh, it just means you're in the care of the government. It's they're now your mum and dad, so to speak. Yeah, basically, you've been put into the care of the system.
Okay. So what happened from there? You went to Darick and you must have committed a crime to go there.
So leading up to there, so what happened is I got out of the orphanage, right, and I went through a really brutal rape in the family home by an Uncle Pat. It was quite violent and quite brutal. I also had an incident where my mother attacked me with a knife and cut open my hand, put stitches in my arm. So I ended up going to my dad's place on the Central Coast where he was living, and I started to run away from home. And obviously they started off, they put me in Warramai, then they put me in Yasmar. Put me in Yasmar a second time, and then they convicted me to Reeby with my brother Jason. But because they had this thing about separating siblings, they put me in Darick and him in Reeby. Yeah, which was in 1980. I went to Darick. I was in Cuma House, which was purple. As you know, there was Bunda, Wallara, Cuma, and Daru. I was in the third house, which was purple. Mr. Holt ran Cuma with Mr. Bush and Mr. Bulins.
How old were you at Darick? 13.
Yeah, and I was going through a lot of sexual activity at Yasmar, and people were, because I was so young and I looked like a girl, Russell, I was being targeted a lot in Yasmar, and I wasn't actually abused, but there was the threat of it consistently. In the dorms, you know, there was only six on the senior side. Yeah. I'd sleep in that, and all night I'd have a shower and boys were walking up behind grabbing me, and because I was so young, I hadn't even reached puberty, it was like a constant game for them. And then when I got into Darick, I, you know how you have to get up at night time, stamp your foot on the floor to go to the loo? Well, yeah. I got up this night, stamped my foot, and I waited for ages for Mr. Bulins to look at me, and he gives me the nod, and I walk up to the ablution, and as I'm going up, I hear another knock on the floor, and I think, oh, that'll be a while before anything comes of that. But he didn't. He followed me straight up, this tall Aboriginal guy. I call him Gangly. I don't really want to talk about what happened, Russell, but he abused me whilst I was in Darick. It's one of the ones that I haven't talked about a lot because I feel a lot of shame around that I let another kid overpower me. Yeah. You know, like I feel guilt around that. But what's happened is I got out of Darick, and this is where it starts to get insane, Russell. So I went to Docs when they let me out of Darick, and I said, look, I'm sick of being bashed up by my parents and sexually abused and all these other things that are going on in my life. I don't want to go back into institutions. Please just give me somewhere to go. So they said, we can give you a foster place to go in Mount Druitt, right? What they didn't tell me, Russell, was before I went there that this was a three-bedroom house. It had 9 adults living in there. Of the adults that were living in there, in the back room that I'm in, there's 3 adult men and me in 2 bunks. 2 of them, prior convictions for sexual assault, right? So one raped a 2-year-old boy who rapes me the whole, you know, abuses me pretty much the whole time I'm in care, in their care. Above me is a guy named David Drake, who abuses a girl that was also a foster girl. And then a third one, a boy named Malcolm, who was shot dead by police at Emerton in Mount Druitt, McDonald's in 1979.
Yeah, beaten.
Yeah, all 3 of them were in their care. And like, how is they put me in that place, Russell? I'm getting abused. I've had a gutful of it. I go back to my mum. She doesn't want me. I get sent back to Sydney to meet my dad on a bus, and he literally dumps me in Oxford Street. You know, I'm 13 years old. I'm nearly 14 now. I'm dumped bang on the streets of King's Cross. And as you know, I land in a refuge that was founded by a children's magistrate judge, and it was run also by Bob Hawke and Barry Unsworth and 8 other judges. And it was run by 5 pedophile men and a woman. I've spent the last 27 years of my life, I've been through 2 Royal Commissions, the Woods Royal Commission and the Royal Commission into Institutional Abuse. I've been through 4 trials and an extradition, and I've convicted 4 of these men now.
Mate, you are a hero, brother. Like, I really want to talk about that. I really want to, because it's really important. That's a warrior. I mean, I take my hat off to you, man. I really do. I'm so proud of you, what you've done. What happened after the abuse? How did you feel? What did it do to your self-belief system? And
it crushed me, Russell. So after the refuge closed, as you know, I had a girlfriend as well. She was 15. She got murdered by 2 men that were looking for a girl for the night. I confronted 2 of my abusers after the refuge was closed. And I said, one day, I said, I'm going to hold all of you bastards accountable. I said, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to tell the world what you've done. And he laughed in my face, Russell. And he said, you're a heroin addict. You're a junkie. You know, you'll be lucky to live to 21. And the sad part of that story, Russell, was I started doing crime, selling drugs, stick-ups, doing all sorts of stuff and end myself up in jail. Then I get out of there, I'm on methadone. I've got a heroin habit for the next 35 years that I just can't deal with because I just can't handle what's happened. I get these flashes all the time.
Was there a heroin use? Let's talk about how you become a heroin user and what was the purpose of it.
So how it starts off is at the refuge where Simon created a platform where we could do whatever we want. We could drink alcohol, we could take drugs. So I spent that time there learning, if you like, how to, you know, use the different kinds of drugs. It was after Linda died, like when Linda started heroin, I was trying in my heart to stop her from doing it. When she died from the heroin, I thought, what is this that they're so hooked up on? And so I went and started using it. And the minute I took it, Russell, it's like it turned off my head. All that stuff that was flashing through my head was suddenly removed. You know, all that distortion and noise, those voices, that anger. But the problem was I spent the next 35 years chasing that feeling. You know, it was never the same as that very first time when it shut everything down.
Oh, man. But isn't it, I remember my first shot of heroin, all of the shame, all of those horrible feelings I felt from the abuse got put in their place, that they were silenced. Is that what you found?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with me, mate. The minute I started using the gear, it was like it was the medication for the soul for a survivor. It was almost like it shut off everything. It was like an instant switch. But the problem was that I didn't realize that I was out of the pot and into the fire. It stopped the way I was feeling about the abuse, but there's a whole lifestyle of addiction that goes with it, as you and I know, the crime and the prisons and the on the streets every day bustling for a buck.
So you begin using heroin on a daily basis?
Yeah, I did. And what I slowly started doing worse and worse. You know, like I first started using and I started robbing people on the street. Like I was literally going down in back lanes, waiting for someone to score and jumping out and king hitting people just to take their heroin, because I literally had no learning, Russell, how to make money. I had no idea on how to get money. So the only thing that was available to me was the violence that I'd grown up with. So I took straight to doing that kind of stuff. Lucky for me, unlucky for me, whichever way you want to look at it, I ended up meeting a big time dealer, and I had this way of working my way up the chain, you know, until I found that I was suddenly selling heroin for some big guys at camps, you know, and did that for a few years as well.
So you developed this survival mechanism on the street to sustain your heroin use, which was the subject at the end of the day. It was funny because I was watching a podcast, Simon Atwood, who's an English podcaster, was saying like in England, it's like 95% of heroin users were the victims of pedophiles.
Yeah.
Would you agree on those sort of stats?
I would. I don't know if 95 is quite so high. That's very high. But I do believe that a big portion, you know, probably 80% of people who are using drugs have had some sort of heavy trauma, often attributed to sexual abuse.
Do you think you would have used heroin if you weren't abused?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, same here. I don't think I ever would have went down that track. Okay, so you're using heroin. What led you to prison?
So what actually happened was I met this beautiful girl. I tried to get my life together. I tried so hard, Russell. I got on methadone. I was working. But back then, the rules around methadone were so different. So first time I got put on methadone, they put me on 60 mils, and then I had 3 weeks with which, and then they rapidly detoxed me off it, which actually made my habit worse. So I'm trying to build this relationship with this woman. Then what actually happens is she does the wrong thing by me and sleeps with my brother, which literally crushes me. Here's where I go really feral, you know. I just start doing really dumb shit, and I end up getting arrested, put in Long Bay, MRC, 13 wing, and I have to wait for a year to get Supreme Court bail. They give me bail to Odyssey House, but I jumped out of the van on the way.
You know, Odyssey House is a rehabilitation centre out at Campbelltown, yeah?
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. Well, right. I jumped out of the van on the way to there, took off to South Australia, got off the petrol and the heroin, and then came and handed myself in, done my jail. I just didn't want to do it on methadone. As you know, the last thing you want to do is be on methadone in jail.
Can you describe, people have asked me over the years, how do you describe heroin withdrawals? What would your description be of a heroin withdrawal?
Picture yourself with a really bad flu, you know, with the hot and cold flushes, your body's jumping out of its skin all the time. Everything tastes funny. Everything smells funny. And what it really affects is your emotional stability. You know, like I found that when I was in withdrawals is when I struggled with my mental health the most. It's the time where I got the flashbacks. It's the time where I started remembering stuff. I just couldn't handle being straight. I needed something to stop the thought processes going on in my head.
It's often described as hell. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Your analogy of the flu is very similar to what I say. And I say, well, think about the worst flu you ever had and times it by 10.
Yeah.
And that'll give you a bit of an indication of what the withdrawals from heroin.
People
can
don't
be
understand.
Like. And you're right. You hit the nail right on the head. That confrontation of the nightmares, like the nightmares don't go away, do they?
No, they don't. And that's that's where I'm really struggling in my life now. Is that I don't know why, but for some reason or another, it seems to be really affecting me since court's ended. I wake up, I'm getting visions of stuff all the time. But where I really find it is silly things like TV or music. You know, something will come on TV and then suddenly it'll trigger a memory, and then I just feel like this rage or anger inside me. And I just don't want to feel that anger anymore. Like I've held it for so long, you know what I mean? And it's just like I thought by taking them all to court and putting them in the jail that I'd get some sort of respite from how I feel. But the truth is that it doesn't quite play out the way you hope it would.
Yeah, we're going to get that. I want to get to that, and it's a really important part of your story. I really want to talk about that. In and out of jail, trying to get straight. Talk us a bit through that. How much jail did you end up doing?
So the first 11 months I did in prison was really hard because I spent it withdrawing, you know, and as you know, if you're a heroin addict and you're doing time in prison and you're spending so much of it in maximum, I found it really hard. But when I got sentenced, I actually found jail life a lot easier than living on the street. I was fed three times a day. I had 100 mates. I could play chess, cards, table tennis, do weights, play touch football. You know, like it was the first time in my life where I actually had stability from drug use. I'd been using so friggin' long. So from the age of 15 till 24 had just been blitz of heroin and methadone. So the first 2 years I spent in jail, I spent on fitness, you know, running every day, playing touch football and trying to learn stuff because I didn't get schooling. So I did general certificate of education. I actually enjoyed jail. I know that sounds strange. You probably understand it.
Yeah, I understand institutions. It. Yeah, I definitely do understand it. And you find a sense of safety in there, don't you?
That's how I felt. I felt I didn't have to worry about anything. Like out on the street, I was worrying where I was going to sleep that night, what I was going to eat, my drug use. Suddenly I'm in jail. I don't have to think. They're doing my thinking for me. I just get up in the morning, eat my food, you know, go to the
porridge
gym
in the day. Remember the porridge?
The porridge is a great
effort. We used to get up and have a big thing of porridge. And back then in the 80s, jail was a lot different. I think it was a bit more rehabilitation focused than it is today, unfortunately. Yeah. But you form a brotherhood with these people that you can trust. Not too dissimilar to people that go to war together, so I'm told by psychiatrists and psychologists.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got out, mate, and what was it like getting out?
When I first got out of jail, I'm surprised I didn't go back in. Like literally the very first night I got drunk and got into a fight in a pub, and I was lucky that the barman came up to me and said, listen, mate, get in a cab, go home, or you're going to find yourself back in jail. So I found it hard adjusting when I first come out to life. But I really had a crack at it. I went and got a job, had a real go at my life. The problem was my addiction was, you know, too close to me. So I kept struggling. I'd get off, I'd get back on, I'd get off, get back on. I tried to start a little family, you know, I've got now four kids and a partner. And then all of a sudden the Royal Commission comes into my life, you know, and literally turned the table upside down.
Because you would have went through the Wood Royal Commission first, the Wood Royal Commission, 94, was it 94 or 96 into the police
95
corruption?
It started, 96 is when I went.
Okay. There was a Wood Royal Commission into police corruption and you got pulled into that, did you?
That's right, yeah.
And what was that about?
So what actually happened was they started it off as into corruption of police, but they learnt very quickly that the police were protecting pedophiles. See, how it worked was that the kids on the street used heroin, the police supplied the heroin, the predators supplied the money to buy the heroin, so they were looking after the predators because it was in their best interest to protect the money source. So after the Woods Royal Commission started going, Justice Woods realised that pedophilia was rife on the streets of King's Cross and by high-profile people. So he extended the Woodrow Commission not only into corruption but into pedophilia around King's Cross and the involvement with police into that.
I remember Justice Yeldham, when he got called into the Woodrow Commission, went and committed suicide. He was a Supreme Court judge.
So can I tell you about Justin Yeldham, right?
Yeah, please.
So Justin Yeldham used to approach little boys in the toilets at Wynyard and Museum Station. Linda Kirby, my girlfriend, as you know, she was murdered when she was 15. They caught the killers of Linda, convicted them both to 20 years in prison. Then they appealed, went before Justice Yeldham and were dismissed. And then just not long after that, Justice Yeldham took his own life when he was questioned before the Woodrow Commission about how he was being compromised. Because the police knew that they had him over a barrel, which meant that he was literally in their pocket.
He was getting arrested all the time for approaching young children. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, all the police knew what he did and all the street knew.
Because I remember Rogerson and that was that team, the really bad team. They could use Justice Yeldham, if they had a criminal on their books, they could get him bail in front of Justice Yeldham or get him smashed, you know, a really high sentence if they didn't comply to their demands.
Yeah. The connection between King's Cross Police and the court system back in the 80s was so bad, you know, that there's a lot of blokes that were set up and put away by the system. You either played their game or you didn't. And if you didn't, you know, you found yourself set up for long periods of time for things you didn't even do.
How prolific in them days was child sexual abuse in that era?
Absolutely rife, mate. So King's Cross back in the 80s, it was rife with street kids and it was rife with predators. Like literally everywhere you went were predators. Mate, I used to sit in a group with my mates and you'd see one standing against the pole, right, just leaning there, and they'd be waiting for you to look their way. And they're like, come over here. Or if you left the herd, went to the shop to buy something to eat, bang, they're straight onto you, following you. Everywhere you go, they were literally everywhere on the streets.
Wow. And these police were protecting them because a lot of them were wealthy sort of men and that, weren't they?
They were, bro. They were people from positions of power. They were people, movie stars, TV stars, politicians, judges, mums and dads. You know the most common ones? School teachers. Mate, yeah. How many times you see school teachers down there buying little boys and little girls? You know, they must work in these schools all day looking at these kids and then think, oh, I want a bit of that. And so they go down the cross and purchase children, you know, like destroy lives.
Crazy. That's crazy. I can remember the days of going up there, like we'd steal cars and go up there and the pinball parlours and that, the amount of old men and that were hanging around there preying on children. I can remember too the amount of prostitutes on the wall at the time, you know, underage prostitutes, and the cars pulling up were Mercedes-Benz and Rolls-Royces. And
yeah.
Now they do it on computers. Now they groom them on computers.
Yes.
Right at this current time, there's how they normalise themselves and they snuck in through the Catholic Church. They snuck in the boys' home system, foster care system. Now they're in the police force, underage strip searching and all that sort of stuff. What's your take on this underage strip searching? What you got? I'm really passionate about.
I don't think they should be putting hands on children ever.
Mm.
You know, I remember up the cross years ago, Russell, there was a time where everyone was carrying balloons in their mouth and you could be walking along the street and get your Adam's apple broken by a copper. They just literally walk up from out of nowhere and just go bang and hit you straight in the throat and like tell you to spit and tough luck if you're chewing gum or don't have it in you. But there should be no time where we're putting hands on children, ever.
All right. I just want to backtrack. What was in them balloons?
Heroin. We used to get Panadol capsules and you'd buy them empty, like buy the bucket load, you know, and then we'd sit there all day and you'd put 1 point in each cap and then you put them in a balloon, like little water balloons, and then you carry them in your mouth. So what it meant was that if the police come, you could just swallow them and you could bring them back up later. You know, you wouldn't lose your gear. But it also meant you could take it out of your mouth, give it to the addict. The addict could do the same thing, and then if he got arrested, he could swallow it and get it back later too.
Yeah, yeah. What did you do at the Wood Royal Commission? You have to give evidence.
So I was living with a big-time cocaine dealer who was dealing for the police. So I had an involvement where there was a lot of interaction between this drug dealer and the police supplying cocaine. And also I gave evidence about the police that were protecting specific abusers. But I gave them 22 names, two of which I took to court through the Wood Royal Commission. One was named Ken Fogarty, who got 18 months, and the other one's name was Paul Jones, who got 18 months.
And what was that for, child abuse?
Yeah, so Paul Jones was a counsellor at the refuge, but he also had his own house in Corunna Road, Petersham, where he had about 20 street kids living there. And basically what he did was he just created this house where they just smoked pot all day, and he at leisure, he was a masseuse. He used to take them upstairs to his room and abuse them. And he abused so many children and he got 18 months. Like it is absolutely ridiculous that this guy got 18 months for armed robbery. You know, you're looking at big sentences, but if you go and rape a child, you're lucky to get 2 years jail.
You know, my co-accused, Barry Hull from Mount Druitt, and he went up on his charges and the pedophile went up on 19 counts of touching children and got 18 months. And his lawyer said, oh, well, this bloke just went before you. You should be right. This judge is kind and compassionate. Barry went up on 16 armed robberies and got 19 years.
Yeah.
That was the disparity in sentencing. It's crazy. How does it make you feel when you see those soft sentences?
Angry. You know what it says to me? It says that's my value. When I've spent 2 years giving evidence at the Wood Royal Commission, then I go through the trial. And the thing about the trial was that I was subjected to the laws governing the time of the abuse. So the laws are changed now, Russ, and they're a lot better for victims. But back then they weren't. They meant I had to be at court every day. All my witnesses had to be at court every day. And they could say to you whatever they want. And then after all of that, what actually happened was with Paul Jones, we broke for lunch, right? I was sitting down eating lunch outside of court when all of a sudden he comes up to my table and he's sitting, standing right next to me, and he says, I want to say that I'm so sorry to you, Glenn, for what I did to you and your, I won't say who the other victim was, but what I did. And then he went back to court and rolled over because he'd actually pled not guilty. And then they gave him 18 months because he pled guilty. But then the next guy I took to court didn't plead guilty. He went through a 2-week trial and he got 18 months anyway.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah, the system's a joke.
We live in a society where money has got more value than a child's innocence. It's crazy.
And that's what it all comes down to, Russell, and back, if you're going backwards, that's exactly what it was all about. The money was worth more than the kids. Do you know, there was just too much money on the streets for them to ignore.
Amongst inmates in prison, there's that old saying, you would have heard it before, you can touch my children, but don't touch my video recorder.
Yeah.
You know, meaning, you know, someone's, you know, video, someone's personal property is worth more than their children's innocence. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Mate, my hero is a woman called Julia Gillard. I love Julia Gillard. I think she was the one who pushed to bring the Royal Commission into institutional responsive to child sexual abuse, whilst the LNP all opposed it and said there was no need for it. You know, sitting back and watching that, like, I sort of seen that happen and I was like, this is going to give me a little bit of hope. Because all through your journey, you've tried to get straight, go straight, and that the wounds weren't healing. You know, did you find that? Is that was the thing that always held you back?
And what hurt was that I kept coming forward and people weren't listening. I was telling my story right back in the 80s, and many of us were. We were saying it over and over and over. We kept demanding a Royal Commission into institutional abuse. You know, you grew up the same time as I did, Russell, through them boys' homes. And Yasmar, Darrick, Minda, Cobham, Bajura, Warramai, Albion Street, Mount Penang, these are filthy places, mate, that no child should ever have been sent to.
It was crazy. With the benefit of hindsight and looking back on it, I always felt it was government sanctioned, that abuse.
Yeah, I agree with you. They modelled Darrick off something in America that was, I don't quite remember the story, but same with Yasmar after Sunbun Ramsey. Yeah, I do believe that abuse was sanctioned. It was too rife, too much. There was no... They were all doing it in every institution. Yeah. So makes you believe that it wasn't by chance.
I've talked about this. When I was at Darrick, I was in Daru and then I was in Bunda. The house, when we talk about these houses, like they had 35 kids in different houses, which are dormitory situations. Bunda was determined on your behaviour. If you had bad behaviour, you'd go to Bunda.
Yeah.
Well, I ended up, the abuse was taking place. But of a night time, the officer's box that I used to see people in that box that I'd never seen before, which sort of made me later think as an adult, maybe a pedophile ring was operating out of there, because there was people coming in of a night time, going in the ablutions block, shower block, toilet block with kids that I'd never seen before. I've just seen that a couple of times.
Yeah, there's definitely some connection between outside and inside. I mean, I saw a lot of it later at the Cross by seeing some of the people that worked in Darrick who were at the wall or at the park, one of being Mr. Bush and the other one, Mr. Holt. So they were pretty well known, Mr. Webster as well, for what he did with other kids. So I was lucky. I never got abused in Darrick by officers, but I only did a general, so 4.5 months. So I guess I was lucky there. But I went through a hard time in Darrick, Russ, with other kids, specifically
bullying? Was that through bullying? You're getting bullied?
Bullied and sexually abused by an older Aboriginal boy.
Okay.
I hadn't even reached puberty, Russell, when I was in Darrick. It was a common joke amongst the other kids. Like, I was so young. And I looked young, you know, people used to say to me, what are you even doing here? Like, you don't look like you should be here. And I wasn't much different in age, only a year different. But I looked so much younger. Do you know Fred Collette?
I know Fred Collette, yeah.
Yeah, Fred Collette was the first person to stick up for me in Darrick. He actually stood beside me one day and he said, this little kid's got more ticker than half the blokes in here. Because I used to have a crack. I just didn't have the size to back it. But I always had a crack, Russell, and he used to say, this kid's got more ticker than half the blokes of you in here, and he's the one that stopped what happened to me happening.
I was there in 84.
Yeah, you're a bit younger than me. I was there in 80.
Yeah, I was there in 84, and it was a very somber place, Darrick. It was a very, very somber place where, you could feel the spirits of those kids being broken on a daily basis.
Yeah, you could. And one of the things the officers did was they used other kids as their means to deal out punishment. For example, if I didn't make my bed properly, rather than stripping my bed and say, Fisher, make your bed again, it's everybody strip your bed. Fisher doesn't know how to make his bed. Until Fisher makes his bed right, all of you will be making beds all day. And then, you know, that's an automatically target. You know, I spent a lot of time under the TV at Darrick.
Underprivileged. Yeah. And they used to have, when I was there, when they told me, they said, do you want to join a band? And I was thinking, band, yeah, I want to join. You know about band practice. And what they do, they get these dry scrubbers. The dry scrubbing, right? And so you got a wooden scrubbing brush on a wooden floor and you got to scrub the brush and then they've got to make a noise or you get bashed. So three coming back, three going up, and it's got to make a perfect sound Otherwise, you'd get bashed for it.
And you think, remember them polishers? The band. Do you remember them big polishing machines?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember them controlling me, mate. You tip them up this way to go that way and down this
and
way.
Fly around.
It was bigger than I was. That was in Yasmo. I remember scrubbing the ablutions in Darrick with brushes, like little brushes. Like if you got into trouble, you'd sit there and do the trough, like with a toothbrush, and then little tiles over and over.
This trough, yeah.
Yeah, in the troughs, that's right. I didn't like Darrick at all, mate. I didn't like matrons much either.
I just want to explain what a matron was. A matron was an old woman that would come in there and she would distribute the clothing and the bedding and you know, make sure you got your clothing. And they were just old witches. I don't mean to bag witches, but like nasty witches. Yeah, I know there's the white witches and they're beautiful people, but nasty witches. And a lot of kids reported the abuse to them women and they just covered it up.
Yeah, that's right.
Just as bad as the abusers. Let's fast forward. Let's go to the Royal Commission Institution Responses to Child Abuse, which is close to my heart.
Yeah, mine too.
All right. What happened there? How did you end up in there?
So I've been involved with Forgotten Australians for years, and I've also been involved with local member here who helped me publish my book. I was spoken to and they said, look, you really should give these names to the Royal Commission into Institutional Abuse, all the names that you've given, because I went through the foster care system. I went through just about every single institution you can think of in New South Wales, as most of us did back then. So I went in and I wanted to tell them about what happened to me at Darrick, but more so how I got there. Like, I still to this day don't believe I should have been in Darrick, Russell. I was 13. I was supposed to be in Reby, and separating siblings I just don't think was right.
I agree. I agree with that. And did you do a private session or did you give evidence in the commission?
I did a private session with, can't think of his name, Murray, Commissioner Murray.
I done a private session when I was so disappointed. I was so disappointed because they were interested in the law firm that I was going to use.
Yeah, I was disappointed. I actually had a friend tape my whole evidence, and then after I actually got quite upset with him and made him delete it, right? Then I found out 2 days later that they'd sealed my file for 99 years. I literally sealed my file. And I'm like, what was the point of me speaking up and telling you all about what's happened if you're going to seal our files for the next 99 years so nobody ever knows what we've told you?
Was that right? Your file got sealed. And what's his name? Who was that politician that Southern's list? What's that 99? Remember how they had that 99-year suppression order on that list? Is your evidence part of that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, see, Bob Hawke was on the committee of the Homeless Children's Association. So was a lot of high-profile people. And there was connections, like, with docs. There's a lot I said about docs. So they sealed my file. Like, they sealed everyone's file from that institutional abuse that gave evidence.
Yeah, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I think a lot of good came out of that Royal Commission, but I think a lot got held back.
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes in the system, Russell, that are a lot better now today for survivors. The police are trauma-informed. They're better informed. They're better with historical abuse. There's a whole lot of things that have changed for the better, but we're still a long way removed from where we need to be.
And I think what blokes like yourself and myself are trying to do is trying to create a safer platform for abuse survivors to come out and tell their story.
Absolutely.
And it's important, isn't it, mate?
It is. Look, I'm going to say something, and this is just being truthful about who I was. So when I got out of prison, I was the dirtiest prick on the planet. I really was. I was so freaking angry, Russell, with what had happened to me in my life that I just walked around life bitter. I was fighting with everyone. I just had so much drama. You know what I mean? It changes who you are.
100%. But so does healing. And you know, I got to tell my story. That's when the healing began, when I realised that all this bullshit I carried didn't belong to me. By telling it, you hand it back to its rightful owner. And what you've done, Glenn, you've inspired a lot of people. I have no doubt, you know, you've been on Current Affair. So many people have contacted me. You've been on Current Affair telling your story, and it's being vulnerable. You know, how important is being vulnerable to you? How important is being vulnerable to people to tell their story?
It's imperative. Because what I was alluding to before was that I kept it all inside me, which just made me toxic. And it wasn't until I started speaking about what had happened to me with honesty that I started to feel the healing process begin. And some people, you just need to, you know, we need to talk about this stuff. You've got to understand and put into perspective, we were children. We weren't adults, we're children. And as parents, look at your own child at the ages they go through as to when our abuse happens. And that should put things into perspective for you when you realise just how young a mind is.
I look at my son, I was looking at him when he was about 15 and I was going, fuck, how did that happen?
Yeah.
You know, I was looking at him and going, fuck, how did anyone, I couldn't imagine anyone hurting him. Like he was so fragile and so small and used to make me sad. But that whole healing journey, I find by the more I tell my story, the more I heal.
Yeah.
You're finding that, mate?
I am. And what's really helping me is that I find that I'm helping other people. If you and I can create a platform of three things, one is, so what happened to you and me never happens again. That's where we need to start off at. Secondly is that if we can let men and women know, and specifically in our case men, that it's okay to speak up, it's okay to be vulnerable, and that people are listening, you know, and that self-blame stuff that we do. Take that away and put the blame where it belongs, on your abusers.
Recently you had a court case. What was that court case about?
So what happened was one of the guys that ran the refuge, Simon Davies, he's the leading privacy advocate in the world. I've been trying to get him since 83. And then after, as you know, I wrote a book. So after I wrote the book, I wrote to politicians and I went and seen a lawyer and they took me to Sex Crime Squad and they made up what's called Strike Force Boyd, where they were going to target every single person in the refuge. I got the first guy, Grant Morris, but Simon Davies fled to London, right? Even though he was named multiple times by multiple people in the Woodrow Commission, they allowed him to leave the country. What then happened was he rang up his solicitor who told him that if he goes to a certain country in Europe, that under statute of limitation laws, he will negate all the charges. So that's what he did. He took off to the Netherlands and he missed the country that he should have got. I won't say what it is online for obvious reasons. If he had gone to that country, he would have got off all his charges. When he got, in 2016, the police came out, put a red notice out with 18 charges, four victims against Simon Davies. He handed himself into the Netherlands, but under the statute of limitations, two victims lost all their charges and from 18 charges dropped down to 9. So that's something that we need to address in this country, whereas somebody can do a serious crime in our country against a child, flee to Europe and negate all charges under statute laws. That's sad.
Mm. And what happened? Did they bring him back?
They did, mate. So on the most serious one against me, he was extradited back to Australia and he got 10 years.
Oh, good.
Yeah, with 6 on the bottom.
And did you give evidence in that trial? Was that Downing Street?
I did. I'm the main victim. I'm the one that came forward for him. I am so proud of it, bro, because like I said, in 83, I went up to him and I said, one day I'm going to hold you accountable, mate. And I said, one day I'm going to tell the world what you did. And he laughed in my face, Russell. And it took me another 45 years before I got him before a court. And when I did, he rolled over like I knew he would and went to jail where he deserves to be.
Beautiful. I love a happy ending. I love that. I love seeing it when they think they're just untouchable. And things are changing. Things that people are talking.
Yeah.
You know? And I talk about this. Pedophiles are sly, yeah? They've snuck into every community. They've snuck into the churches and the churches have covered them up and they've snuck in. Well, they were in the boys' homes when we were there in the foster care system. They're in everyday community. They're in the bloke that lives 5 doors down from your house that votes for fucking the ALP and you know, wants the tough on crime campaigns. And one day the federal police turn up and he's got 50,000 images. They've sneaked in, you know, they sneak in every community, these Balenciaga ads and where they're trying to normalise and trying to get us used to it all, you know what I mean? What do you say to that?
What I've noticed is that pedophiles get themselves into positions of power and into places where children are, and they're very apt at doing it. But my biggest anger lies with those that know and do nothing. You'll find in nearly every case of abuse, there's been somebody that could have stopped it. Nearly almost every case where it's in an institution, in a church, where it's been reported, somebody's spoken up and people are covering it up. I have more anger at those that knew and did nothing.
I push for a couple of things. Those people should be charged with null and concern.
Absolutely.
There shouldn't be a charge of possession of implements, images. It should be accessory after the fact, you know, and then that ups the sentence and that sort of thing. So if someone gets part, that's not possession of implements, child sexual images. That's accessory after the fact. The video, the movies would have never taken place if it wasn't for someone willing to buy it.
Absolutely.
Tell us about your book, mate. Have you got a copy there?
I do. So the book's called Predator's Paradise. As you know, I write a lot of poetry, and I've been doing a lot of writing for years, but I only went to year seven, so I struggled a little bit writing the book. But I had this lovely lady that came in and made it a little bit more succinct and tidied it up for me. And it took me a decade to write it, but I believe had I not written this, I would not have got the justice I got. I mean, I don't know that. It's just an assumption, but I believe my writing the book forced people in positions to move on what I'd said.
How can our listeners get a copy of your book, mate? Where can they purchase it?
Okay, so if you go to Amazon.com or go to Kindle and just type in Predator's Paradise, the other option is if you just message me on either TikTok or on Facebook, and I'll send you the bank details, and then I sign a copy and post it. I've sent most of the ones that I've sent. That's how I've done it. Yeah, but either way, it's fine.
Mate, I have no doubt that you and I will be doing a lot of work in the future. We share the similar passion. I would love to hook you up with FACA, the Fighters Against Child Abuse. You know Adam? You ever touch base with Adam?
Yeah, I do know Adam.
Top bloke. We interviewed him last week, so he's on next week, actually.
Okay.
It's amazing how we're all coming together. We're uniting. And we're going to cause them a lot of trouble, these fucking rats.
Absolutely. It's time that men start speaking up, Russell, and men like you and me, men who have lived the life of, you know, we've spent our life in the system, growing up on the streets, and we've been through addiction. So we're speaking from a place of knowing and compassion. You and I both have absolute empathy for other men out there that are silent. And if you are silent, even if you don't want to come forward, just speaking to someone else that's your mate, that you can say, hey, listen, bro, this is what happened, and I really need to get that off my chest. Trust me, it will make you lighter.
Glenn Fisher, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the sticker.
Thank you, Ross.